Congress is hollowing out the Defense Department and turning the nation's military into a paper tiger of global proportions, according to Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and former special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations. He is my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. He and his colleague Todd Harrison write about the Defense Department's fiscal 2015 budget process on Capitol Hill and how it forces the Pentagon to ignore its own budgetary wisdom. Brian, it's great to have you on the program this afternoon. You're writing in Politico about the NDAA process and where it is taking Congress, and this is a pretty stark portrait that you're painting here, it sounds like, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Francis, for having me on. Todd and I were very concerned, Todd Harrison, were concerned about how the Congress was treating the budget that the President had submitted for the Defense Department. In particular, we were concerned that some of the choices that the Department made to try to slim down and become more of a leaner and ready force were being thrown out in favor of keeping a larger force, an older force, that maybe played more to their domestic constituencies rather than thinking strategically about the future of the Defense Department.
You write, the Pentagon, of course, does not want to make these cuts, the cuts that you refer to and that we've talked about on this program, that both the HASC and SASC are proposing. It simply has no better alternative given the budget constraints Congress established in the 2013 Bipartisan Budget Act and 2011 Budget Control Act. The reality of the situation is no matter how handcuffing those cuts are, they're the law of the land until somebody changes something, Brian. So it strikes me that the base of your argument is certainly a legitimate position, but that both of those pieces of legislation need to go before anything else can happen. Am I on target there?
Yes, Francis. So what Congress did was, you know, create some limits on the Defense Department budget with these two laws in an attempt to reduce defense spending, you know, because they obviously we're leaving two ground wars and we're probably going to a period where we're going to spend less on defense. The Defense Department then responded by submitting a budget that, at least for FY15, was within those caps that Congress had created. And so to stay within those caps, the Defense Department had to make some choices about eliminating programs that it didn't feel like were as relevant for the future environment, and it just couldn't afford, given the constraints Congress put on them. So things like the A-10, things like the KC-10 tanker, and from the Navy side, they are looking at trying potentially laying up 11 cruisers and a couple of amphibious ships for a while in an attempt to reduce their costs so that they can stay within the budget caps and then eventually maintain a ready force over the entire period of the Budget Control Act's applicability, which gets out to 2021.
The piece that you write is titled, "If Sequester Economics Continues on Capitol Hill, We Won't Be Ready Next Time There's a War." And the word readiness is found throughout your piece, and through, of course, it's immersed in this conversation that we've been having over the last several months and years. John Harvey, who was former retired now four-star admiral in the Navy and the chief of naval personnel, said on this program a while back, the question is ready for what? And it strikes me that there's still confusion about that, despite the fact that we have a quadrennial defense review out. There are still quite a few critics of that QDR when it comes to understanding exactly what we do want or need to be ready for.
That's a great point. And as the President noted today in his speech at West Point, our foreign policy is going to, at least his foreign policy, is going to rely less on the military instrument and more on diplomacy and economics and those kinds of things in order to advance U.S. interests. But you still need the military instrument to be prepared because that's usually the main threat that you've got to, you know, bring to bear if economics and diplomacy don't pay off. So, for example, in the Syria situation, when the government, when the president was trying to get Bashar al-Assad to give up his chemical weapons, one of the threats that he brought to bear was the potential for airstrikes coming in from Navy ships that were deployed in the vicinity, both in the Red Sea and over in the Eastern Mediterranean. Those ships were deployed and had been deployed as part of their normal deployment cycle and were retained out there for several months for the purpose of maintaining that pressure. And so as they pursued a diplomatic solution, they had to have the military, you know, hammer ready to be brought down if that diplomatic solution didn't come through. Well, that costs money. Being able to keep ships underway on a continuous basis, you know, is about a you know, a quarter of the Navy budget, almost a third of the Navy budget. And so ready for what is sort of, you know, ready for to be able to provide the backup to the initiatives that the administration wants to take on the diplomatic and the economic side, because eventually the military instrument will have to be brought to bear.
To that point of readiness, since your piece, along with Todd, co-written along with Todd, has published in Politico, the SASC has concluded their mark or made a lot of progress on their mark. And Chairman Levin has portrayed this markup versus the HASC markup as a smaller ready force, which is what he says the military will have with the Senate version, versus a larger hollowed out force, which is what he claims the military would have with the House Republican version. Is that a fair portrayal on his part, do you think? And is that an accurate portrayal on his part, Brian?
So the SASC markup does support some of the reductions, some of the cuts that the department wanted to make. So, for example, it would let the Navy lay up some cruisers and amphibious ships to save money in the near term and then modernize them and bring them back into the fleet later on. So that saves, over the course of the five-year defense program, you know, about $4 billion. So there's a savings there. They let the department pursue some of the compensation reductions that the DOD had proposed, like the cost of or housing costs not going up at the same rate. But they still resisted some of the reductions in Army force structure. They wanted to do a commission to look at the size of the Army, so the Army may not get as small as fast as the Defense Department wanted. They didn't let DOD pursue all the compensation reductions they wanted to do. So while the SASC did not go as hard over as the House did in terms of turning down DOD's proposed reductions, they still took a lot of things off the table that DOD had been planning on in order to meet the budget caps. So both the SASC and the HASC are going to produce a military that has more force structure than it needs and is going to be forced to go into the readiness bucket to get the savings to pay for those.
Brian Clark of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, writing with his colleague Todd Harrison in Politico under the title, If Sequester Economics Continues on Capitol Hill, We Won't Be Ready Next Time There's a War. Help me understand the buckets idea here. You and Todd write, the Navy will have to pay for nuclear maintenance on its carriers and submarines and therefore be compelled to forego maintenance on destroyers that are our frontline forces in the Black Sea, Baltic, and East China Sea. Now, of course, you happen to have chosen three locations that are particularly hot right now. I'm sure that was totally random, Brian, right?
Of course
it was. But why is it that – doesn't all that money come out of the same O&M pot?
Right. So how it works is you've got about four major buckets of money that go to the Defense Department. You've got acquisition, so it's procurement and research and development. You've got personnel, compensation, pay. You've got operations and maintenance, and then you've got military construction. So those are the four major buckets of money. Both committees on either side are telling the department to spend more than it planned to on the acquisition part and on the personnel part. So those two buckets are going to have to be filled up more than they currently are. And that military construction bucket is sort of independent, so the Congress controls that on their own, and so the Defense Department can't use that as a place to go for savings. So that leaves only one bucket where the department's going to be able to go to get money out and put it into the acquisition and the personnel side, and that's readiness. So the operations and maintenance accounts are going to be what gets rated to be able to cover the costs of all the things that the Congress is telling the department it has to keep. And so inside that operations and maintenance bucket, you pay for defense civilians, you pay for maintenance on ships and aircraft, you pay for all the fuel that they use to go deploy, you pay for keeping the lights on and cutting the grass and all the base operations. So there's a whole bunch of things in there, and it's pretty much just one big fungible account. But what will happen is certain things have to be paid for. Like I cannot not pay for the base to continue operating. Like I got to keep the airstrips going, and I got to keep the lights on in a lot of places on base. I have to do the maintenance on nuclear ships because there's a safety concern there. So certain things are going to have to get paid for out of that bucket. And what happens is you end up making not very strategic choices because the money I have left when I make cuts to readiness, I've got to pay for the things that got to be paid for, which means certain things which may be less critical, like maintenance on conventional surface ships, that's what often gets put on the wayside. And so those ships that we're depending on to be the front line in those critical regions in the world are the very ships that are going to end up suffering because we're not going to be able to pay for their maintenance because I had to pay for all the other must-pays inside the operations and maintenance account.
And it's ironic because, as you and Todd explain in this piece, those kinds of decisions that Congress makes, you write, take it out of the decision-making process. They're trying to get more control, and by trying to get more control, you write that they're actually getting less.
Exactly. Because they're making choices they think are going to be strategic and they think are allowing them to have the decision power within Congress, but all they're doing is keeping around parts of the force that, in the end, the Defense Department may not be able to pay to maintain. So we're going to keep all the A-10s, for example, or we're going to keep all the KC-10s, or we're going to keep more Army units than we wanted to, but the readiness money isn't going to be there to really pay for them, so they're going to be parked or, you know, idle or not doing anything. And we saw that during the sequestration in FY13. In 2013, when sequestration happened, the department had to go find a bunch of money really fast to save, to be able to, you know, cover the cost of sequestration. Well, that came out of current operations, current maintenance. And so a lot of ships got parked, a lot of airplanes got grounded, and a lot of people were idle, which, you know, obviously doesn't help us in terms of being able to maintain pressure on our potential, our competitors overseas, like you're seeing in these hot regions around the world. But also it doesn't help the quality of service of the sailors and the Marines and the soldiers and the airmen that are now kind of wondering why did they join the military if they're going to be sitting around at a desk all the time instead of flying or sailing or, you know, doing the things that they, you know, they joined the military to do.
Brian Clark's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, writing with his colleague Todd Harrison in Politico. And you can find a link to that piece at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, more with Brian, innovative ways to get around these problems, and we'll talk about those in just a moment on Pentagon Solutions. This is In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Pentagon Solutions every Wednesday to start off the 4 o'clock hour. My guest is Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He and his colleague Todd Harrison writing in Politico under the title, If Sequester Economics Continues on Capitol Hill, We Won't Be Ready Next Time There's a War. We've talked about some of the problems with the budget strategy that Congress has taken so far. But you and Todd write, Brian, there are innovative ways to keep equipment for later while saving money today. And you write about an instance with the Navy proposing doing something with 12 ships. Tell me more about that and why that will work.
So what the Navy had proposed was to take half of their cruiser force, there's 22 cruisers in the Navy, taking half of those and putting them into a reduced operating status. I was calling it layup or mothballing, but in reality it's putting them pier side, reducing their crews down to a minimum, and not operating them for a period of time. And so what they would do is those cruisers are all due for a modernization period where they get upgraded and then they get new combat systems and then they have their life extended. And so this usually happens in the middle of the cruiser's life, and these ships are due for that. They would take these ships out of operation and then bring them back a couple of at a time each year until they're all brought back after about 6 or 7 years. And what that would do is save money in the near term because you won't be paying to operate those ships. And they would also reduce the manning on the ships, so you'd save money because those people could go to other ships where the Navy was going to have to hire new people to go staff up those ships. So the savings overall during the course of the time when these ships are out of the fleet would be about $3 billion, $3 to $4 billion, which is a pretty significant savings. What that also does is on the back end, these ships are now in the fleet longer because they've had their lives extended, and by also being out of the fleet for a few years, they were able to push their end of service life out to near the end of the 2030s. So that was actually really beneficial. So the Navy had this innovative idea for how they could keep that force structure, keep those ships still available in the fleet, but at the same time, save money in the near term when we've got the Budget Control Act caps in place that constrain defense spending. And so the House, the HASC, you know, didn't like that idea because they were uncomfortable with Navy's commitment to actually bring the ships back, because the Navy in the past has taken ships out of the fleet and put them in a reduced operating status and then eventually just decommissioned them, which that was what the House's concern was, that there was no real binding way for the Navy to be held accountable for ensuring they bring the ships back. The SASC went ahead and agreed with Navy's plan and allowed them to do it. So it'll be interesting to see as they go through the conference as to how they deal with that particular change. And so I think the key will be for Congress to think through whether they want to have a larger force down the line that's going to be capable of dealing with the budget constraints that are likely to continue, or do they want to force the Navy to keep these ships now, and then they're going to be retired in short order because they're not going to be as well maintained, and they're going to reach the end of their service life beforehand.
Are there other places besides in the Navy where this will work, and are there any places, if so, that the committees might be more amenable to that kind of a rotation, or is it just the whole concept that they're squeamish about?
The main thing they were concerned about was this idea of taking, in this case, 11 ships out of the fleet and then trusting the Navy to bring them back in some kind of phased modernization plan. The same thing could be done with aircraft, and the same thing could be done with other ships. For example, the Navy proposed doing this with some of their older amphibious ships as well. So it's certainly something that could be applied in other places in the force, and it could be a way for the Department of Defense to keep some of this force structure around that it thinks it would still be able to use in a future operating environment, but then harvest some savings in the near term when maybe it doesn't need it as much. So if we believe strategically that the world is not going to require us to mount a large-scale campaign in the next 10 years, then it may be a good idea to take several elements of the force, put them into some kind of layup status, bring them back over time, and save some money in the near term.
How does this comport with the idea that President Obama talked about today about being more involved in training our allies around the world rather than going to fight on their behalves? It strikes me that what you're proposing fits with that strategy fairly well.
Right. It would. And so, not that I necessarily thought through the implications of Obama's strategy, obviously, in this, but the assessment that we had made, Todd and I had made, and others have made, is the next 10 years are not necessarily going to present the United States with a need for a large-scale military campaign, and that this may be the time for us to take advantage of the lull, if you will, after the end of the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, to do some of this kind of laying up and modernization, and put the force in a better position at the end of this next decade. If we do pursue training of our allies, that would be a good complement to this, just to look for an opportunity to get them to be able to shoulder more of the burden of the kind of day-to-day security operations that occur out there, so that the United States is not having to do it. So, for example, counter-piracy operations in the Gulf of Aden, which have been going on for many years now, those are done almost entirely by NATO, or rather by partner nations such as Pakistan, India. There's NATO countries that do it. China is there. Russia is there. So there's a lot of countries that participate in those counter-piracy operations. And the U.S. normally has a very small presence of one or two ships there doing that. So that's an example of kind of how this burden sharing can result in the U.S. being able to extract itself from some of those kind of long-term security requirements.
Is that assessment based on about the next decade based on the assumed will of the American people right now after a decade plus of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, or is that based on an assessment of looking around the world at our potential adversaries, large-scale adversaries? Because I wonder if you're China or Russia and you're thinking about becoming aggressive, not necessarily directly against the United States, but if you look at the United States and their ability to work with their allies and trump whatever movements you make are hindered because they're in kind of a layup status in a number of different places across their hardware inventory, that would make it seem to me that would be an opportune time to try to make a move you wouldn't have made otherwise.
Right. And so the challenge will be making sure that you don't lay up parts of the force structure that you think are most important to deter those aggressive actions on the part of those countries. One thing to think about here is both China and Russia, while we talk about their militaries becoming more capable and they're modernizing and they're putting more money into them, they're still not well matched against, you know, their nearest potential competitors. So China and Japan, for example, Japan is positioned very well militarily to be able to defend itself from China in the near term. Russia, dealing with NATO could very easily deal with Russian military incursions as long as they didn't escalate to something, you know, nuclear or whatever. That's in the near term. And so maybe in the farther term, as both Russia and China and other countries continue to build up their military capabilities, there will be a point where the United States needs to be able to bolster our allies more directly to be able to deter aggression on the part of those countries. But in the near term, you know, our allies should be able to, you know, provide part of that, but then also the United States has to make sure it retains the right capabilities to be able to support them. So there's parts of the force that maybe aren't as important to those kinds of support operations, and that those can be laid up for a while as we're, you know, trying to retain that force structure over time. And so that's the analysis that has to occur, or what parts of the force really need to be kept in the near term to be able to support those alliances.
Brian, I'm starting to hear more about this idea of layup around town as far as a possibility to help the defense budget over the next several years. And I look forward to having you and Todd and your other colleagues keep me updated as things go on. Thank you very much for your time today, and congratulations on this piece.
Oh, thank you, Francis. It was great. Thank you for having me on.
Brian Clark, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, former Special Assistant to the CNO, and my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. You can read what he and Todd co-wrote in Politico through a link we have at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon, and my conversation with Brian will be posted there, too.